glad you're here this evening. As announced, we're talking about creation science, which is a different type subject than we have been discussing. Yesterday, we were concentrating on issues that dealt directly with the Bible, but there are a great many people in this world who have been convinced that the Bible is not God's Word, and quoting from the Bible doesn't help. There were a lot of people like that in New Testament times that the apostles dealt with, and we see Paul doing that on Mars Hill in Athens. I think we need to learn to do that today as well. These are lessons like what we do present on college campuses, where we deal strictly with the scientific evidence, and I believe we can show evidence for creation strictly from the scientific evidence, as well as from a number of other sources. But that's what we'll be doing this evening. If you have decided and concluded as to what creation science is from what you read in the textbooks or what you read in the newspapers, from the media, I can guarantee you've got the wrong idea. Somehow in journalism school, they program it into their minds. There's a boilerplate that they have to say when they say creation science. That's the people that want to get Genesis in the classroom. Or they just can't imagine any explanation for complex things other than God, and so that's the argument. That's not the argument that we make, and that's not the case that is presented. The purpose of the presentation this evening is to help you understand what it is and how we can approach the subject strictly from science. As to what creation science is, I think a good place to start would be with a Supreme Court decision that addressed that issue. And we see not all of our equipment is working this evening. In the Edwards versus Aguilard case, otherwise known as the Balanced Treatment Act from Louisiana several years ago, it was proposed that we treat in a balanced way the evidence for creation, the evidence for evolution. They decided that was a terrible idea and unconstitutional and ruled against it. And in the process, a number of statements were made that are very interesting. Chief Justice Rehnquist and Scalia said, "We have no basis on the record to conclude that creation science need be anything other than a collection of scientific data supporting the theory that life abruptly appeared on the earth." The scientific data is what this is about. And they had about 15 creation scientists testify in court, and from that there was no evidence on the record to conclude it was anything other than this. And of course they decided contrary to that. But some would think, okay, how do you look at scientific data and distinguish between creation and evolution? Well, let me give you some illustrations. When we look, for example, and consider the origin of a rock like this, how did it come to be shaped like this? And you would conclude probably that over time, through chance, various tumbling would produce that shape. But then we look at a rock like this, and what would you conclude would be the explanation for the origin here? This would be created design. But, you see, you can't do that in the classroom because that's religious. Does that make sense to you? We look at it and we can see evidence of created design strictly from the empirical evidence. And that's science, but disallowed in the classroom in many places. Another example would be if you're walking down the beach, you see these lines that parallel the shore. And they kind of disappear and reappear as the tides come and go. What caused that? What's the best explanation for these lineations that parallel? Well, you would say that's natural, but as you walk further and you see John loves Mary. Did the waves do that? Was this produced by intelligence? But you see, that's the kind of thing they want to disallow. Strictly looking at the scientific facts, we can determine whether this was done through intelligence or whether it occurred naturally. And you can distinguish between the created things and the natural things. A very powerful argument was made a number of years ago by William Paley. And it has become famous and related to his name. He wrote the book Paley's Natural Theology. And one of the main arguments involved the watch that you might walk along the beach and pick up and decide, how did this watch get here? Does this necessarily infer a designer, a watchmaker? Well, that's a very powerful inference that you have to have a watchmaker if you've got a watch. Well, this prevailed for, I think, a number of years, but then science says, no, that doesn't really work in the biological area. That's not really a necessary inference if you're talking about biology. You don't find watches in biology, which is just not true. You find things much more complex than that, and the complexity is multiplying as we learn more about it. Interestingly, in science, back in 2008, there was an article about cyanobacteria that have daily cycles. This is sometimes called blue-green bacteria. And they know what time of day it is. They know when to do certain things in certain cycles. Well, how do they do that? They have a watch. They have a clock. The biochemical machinery, according to science, is a ratcheting mechanism by which the oscillator ticks unidirectionally. It can go this way, but it can't go back, just like you see in the gears of a clock. It has cogs, it has gears, and this system reveals the molecular mechanisms of biological timekeeping. That's how it keeps time. It's got the gears and the cogs and the ratcheting mechanism. You have Paley's watch in the bacteria. Now, what does that infer? That just happened all by itself. Well, you wouldn't infer that if you found it on the beach. But why does it automatically disappear, that powerful inference, when we look at the bacteria? Looking throughout biology, we see, I think, unmistakable evidence of design. Just recently, 2013, we have a creature with interlocking gears. Did you know about that? We see that in cars. But here are gears that look like what's in the cars. That's in this creature that's being described. Gears are ubiquitous in the man-made world, found in items ranging from wristwatches to car engines, but they're not supposed to be found in living things. But there they are. One of the most amazing machines that we have found in biology involves the bacterial flagellum, or tail on the end of the bacterium. It's an outboard motor. And it runs just like an electric motor. And, well, I say just like. It runs better than ours. It has a rotor. It has a stator, O-rings, bushings, U-joint, drive shaft. What does that sound like? It turns at 100,000 revolutions per minute. How many of you have engines that will do that? What happens to a car engine when you try that? It's going to come apart, isn't it? We can't do that. But this does, and it can reverse direction in a quarter turn. This is an astounding mechanism, more sophisticated than any motor we've ever built. And it just works great as the little bacteria motors around through the liquid medium. It has a network-controlled clutch and brake. It has over 30 coordinated parts, all necessary. One of them is missing, it doesn't work. And how do you get that? By gradual, step-by-step processes. Evolutionary theory says it has to be selected because it's an advantage, but it's not an advantage unless you got all of it together, working. Otherwise, any part would be a disadvantage. That's just, I think, undeniable. It's unmistakable evidence. That's the kind of thing, the scientific data that we're talking about, that distinguishes between that which is natural and that which is created. Darwin said in his book, Origin of the Species, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, and this couldn't, you got to get it all or it doesn't work. If it could be demonstrated you got one that could not have been produced by this gradual successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. I think I see the sense of that, but it's nice to see that Darwin saw it as well. But he didn't know anything about the complexities that we know about today. This is far beyond anything that he imagined. We see then that the definition involves looking at the scientific data from the facts of science, empirical evidence, we can distinguish between the natural and the created. The argument that we make from this is not, well, we can't imagine how this could happen. That's an inference that I can understand. But there's a more powerful scientific inference that's to be made. Science involves what we observe. And from our observations consistently over hundreds of years, our observations confirm that machines are designed. Has anybody seen an exception to that? Machinery is designed. Some of our engineers will say, yeah, that's you don't get machines unless you got to do. That's what we observe. Therefore, when we observe machines in living things, the scientific explanation is they're designed. Now, that's the argument. It's not a failure of imagination. We can't imagine anything that else. It's saying this is what we observe. That's the scientific explanation, therefore. That follows. And I don't think that's been answered. It's usually not even addressed. It's amazing how many people who are atheists will virtually acknowledge the point. Richard Dawkins is one of the leading, most vocal evolutionists in the world, from Oxford. He says in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, from that you can tell where he's coming from, that's what he believes in. Biology, he says, is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. That's not the way it is, but it looks that way. And that's the way you define biology, the way he starts his book. Now, he says that's an illusion. And I said, well, maybe it's what it looks like. I think you'd have to have pretty good evidence to conclude that it wasn't what it looked like it was. Francis Crick, who's one of the more famous scientists in the world, describer of DNA, he says, biologists must constantly keep in mind, because it looks like it was designed, they must keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. You've got to really work at this. Don't look in this direction, look this way. You might say, keep your blinders on. You got to remind, no, it looks that way, but you can't look that way. And so in the biology classroom, the design explanation is typically disallowed. You can't talk about the bacterial flagellum, at least in terms of design. That has been eliminated, and we're not allowing intelligence in that sense in the classroom. And so we conclude that both creation and evolution can be investigated scientifically by looking strictly at the empirical evidence. And we can show that. We also need to recognize that both creation and evolution have profound religious implications. But what we hear often is, well, you can't have creation in the classroom because that's religious and evolution is scientific. And this one's religion, this is scientific, and so I think that's a very naive argument. Both of them can be investigated scientifically, as we've demonstrated. Both of them have profound religious implications. Evolution? Absolutely. Let's allow Richard Dawkins to explain that to us.
And a lawyer said, Dr. Dawkins...
All right. I thought we were... Is our sound hooked up? Do we need to turn that up again? Let's try again. We got too loud
and
last night.
And a lawyer said, Dr. Dawkins, has your belief in evolution, has your study of evolution turned you towards atheism? I would have to say yes.
Particular point that, or something that you read or an experience you had that sort of said, yeah, this is it. God doesn't exist.
Oh, well, by far the most important, I suppose, was understanding evolution. I think the evangelical Christians have really sort of got it right in a way in seeing evolution as the enemy, whereas the more, what should we say, sophisticated theologians who are quite happy to live with evolution, I think they're deluded. I think the evangelicals have got it right in that there really is a deep incompatibility between evolution and Christianity, and I think I realized that at the age of about 16.
The idea there's no religious implication is just foolish. It's very obvious, as he acknowledges. Both of them, creation and evolution, have profound religious implications. Notice, for example, the statement by Isaac Asimov, one of the more famous atheists, recently deceased, but a prolific science writer. He says, I have faith and believe myself. I believe that nothing beyond the natural laws is needed. I have no evidence for this. It is simply what I have faith in. Now, he has chosen to be a naturalist, like some choose to be Catholic or to be Baptist. He's chosen to be that, and he does it without evidence, he says, because that's what he wants to do. He believes, and the unbeliever... Well, it's just unbelievable what an unbeliever has to believe to be an unbeliever. The unbeliever believes that there was nothing, and then nothing happened to nothing, and nothing magically exploded and created everything. You follow that? Then a bunch of everything rearranged itself for no reason into self-replicating parts which turned into dinosaurs and eventually into people. And they believe that. And the evidence for that, well, I think it's negative. That nothing created everything, that a big explosion produced all the order in the universe, that molecules self-assemble and become living cells, and that errors in an information system produce more information. Now that's a blind faith. And it's based on that blind faith, and I don't have that kind of faith. I think integrity demands that we go with the evidence. That's the kind of faith a Christian follows. But in spite of that, that's what we have in our textbooks, in our classrooms, and our tax dollars go to support basically religious propaganda, the faith of humanism, of naturalism, without an alternative, which is the definition of propaganda. They believe that religion, that faith. But we hear the objection sometimes, well, I see the problem, but isn't it illegal to do anything else? And you probably heard that, and the press, I think, thinks that sometimes. That's what they say, but it absolutely is not true. And we have Supreme Court authority for that, back to the same case. In Edwards versus Aguillard, here Brennan, in the majority opinion, says the act does not grant teachers a flexibility they did not already possess. Now, he's arguing against this balanced treatment act. And the reason that he's giving is you don't need it. You've already got the right to teach the alternative view, to supplant the present science curriculum with the presentation of theories besides evolution about the origin of life. Here's the Supreme Court decree that, yes, you do have that right. Teaching a variety of scientific theories about the origins of humankind to school children might be validly done with the clear secular intent of enhancing the effectiveness of science education. He says you can. Stephen Gould was interviewed immediately after this decision was rendered, overturning the constitutionality of that Balanced Treatment Act. The press was saying, now then, it's illegal to teach creation science. Stephen Gould was perhaps the most representative evolutionist in the country at that time, recently deceased. He says, no statute exists in any state to bar instruction in creation science. It could be taught before, it can be taught now. So that was not the effect of the law. But in spite of the negative propaganda, there's a lot of progress being made. I think we're winning. Indicated, for example, in the Zogby International poll, 2009, a nationwide poll, that tested two propositions, teach only Darwin's theory of evolution and the scientific evidence that supports it, which is what is being done in the classroom. 14% agreed. On the alternative, teach Darwin's theory of evolution, but also the scientific evidence against it. 78% agreed, but the 14% prevail, in spite of the propaganda. Now, that is, the 78% is. In 2012, Gallup poll did a nationwide poll questioning, did man evolve by natural processes? Now, this is exactly what's taught in the textbooks. Consistently. How many people believe what they're teaching? 15% believe. I think we're still winning the battle. Not that it's over, but we're certainly making progress. One very encouraging factor has been the professors themselves. In many instances, intimidation and threats of loss of their career and tenure and their positions have deterred, and without that intimidation, I think the situation would be quite different. But in spite of that, there was a very important article that appeared in the New Republic in 2001, where 100 of some of the leading scientists in the country bought a two-page ad in the New Republic and signed their names to the statement, "We're skeptical of the claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life." The Darwinian theory, careful examination, they're skeptical of Darwinism, is what they're saying. And here's their names, 100 scientists from the American Museum of Natural History and from Harvard and some of the leading institutions in the country. Since then, over 800 scientists have joined and signed that statement, all of them with doctorates in the natural sciences, including scientists from the U.S. Academy of Sciences, the Russian, Polish, Czech, and national academies, from such universities as Yale and Princeton and Harvard and Stanford and MIT and Columbia and Purdue and Berkeley and UCLA and Duke, including Cambridge and Oxford. And we don't want to leave out Texas. There were 25 from Texas A&M and 24 from UT. No cheers in either direction there. Close enough. And in both institutions that included professors of geology, both University of Texas and Texas A&M. Rice had 8 signatories, Texas Tech 5, Baylor 6, and Stephen F. Austin did have 1. That signed the statement. Sometimes the smaller schools seem to be more intimidated and threatened by people who don't think they're with the intelligentsia. But here are hundreds of scientists were willing to publicly sign their name. Now, they've got to have pretty secure positions to do this. There are many, many more. And I have, when I'm lecturing on college campus, people come up to me, professors at A&M. I agree with you, Dr. Patton. I just can't make it known or I would lose my position. But you keep up the good work. And that's not unusual. But these are the ones who stated publicly that they do doubt Darwinism. In spite of that, we have men like Ernst Mayr, again, one of the most representative evolutionists in the country, who says no educated person any longer questions the validity of the so-called theory of evolution, which we now know to be a simple fact. Now, I know he knows better. I know he knows. But that's what he says. And it gets printed and repeated. I think a more objective approach is expressed by, of all people, Darwin, who said in The Origin of the Species, in the introduction, a fair result can be obtained only by fully stating and balancing the facts and arguments on both sides of the question. Does that make sense? That seem fair? That's not allowed in most instances. But that's what we're going to try to do now, and we're going to take a break at this point and see if some of you have some questions, and then we'll have another question period after we finish the second session. But who has a question at this point? Yes, sir. They definitely have more freedom. Now, they don't have unlimited freedom. And many of them are homeschooling so that they can teach both sides. Now, they need to educate. But the truth is, the students who have learned both sides in a contested context, a debate context, have a much better educational circumstance. Listening to propaganda is dull, but fighting it out back and forth, which one is better, and debating is much more interesting, and it's been tested over and over. You learn more, and the people who go with the two-model system make better grades on the test. This was tested at University of Texas at El Paso with Dr. Slusher, who was head of the Planetary Science Department, who was a creation scientist. Who was also teaching biology there, and he challenged one of the biology professors, let's both teach from the same book, I'll teach the two-model version, you teach your version, just what's in the book, and then we give our students a common test at the end of the year and see who does better. And his made 20% higher for 3 years in a row, and then they quit testing. It's a better learning situation. But yes, they're able to do that. Many of them do an excellent job. A lot of the schools would like for the homeschoolers to come in and take tests, which they can do in the secular schools because it raises their scores. Who else has a question? Yes, sir. That's really the second position ahead of atheistic evolution. The first, we've still got an edge there, barely. It's not really a scientific question. They approach it exactly like the atheistic scientist does in terms of evidence and what they teach. But they just think God's behind it all back there somewhere. And the question is, would God do it that way? Which is a theological question, not a scientific question. When you look at the New Testament, one of the primary evidences of the supernatural from the miracles was the time factor. Jesus said you're going to get well. If it happened 6 months later, that wouldn't really be much evidence, would it? But it immediately is emphasized over and over. And here's a fellow coming asking for the healing of his daughter, and they found out at that moment back home. That's the moment when she was healed. There's powerful evidence, the time factor. And I think that's also true with the 6 days as opposed to the millions of years. The time factor says that's supernatural. That can't. It's distinguished. But it's a theological question. Would God do it this way? It involves millions of years of death and suffering, and as Darwin said, the fang is red, the claw is vicious. That's the way you evolve. By survival of the fittest, the struggle. Is that the process an all-powerful, all-wise God would choose to produce man? That's just not good theology. And it is a theological question. You're tricked by trying to deal with that scientific. It's not. You need to go straight at the theological aspect of it. Yes, sir? Yes, I've heard of it. I haven't seen it. Yes. Now, I think we've got people that could have done a better job than Ken Ham, but I think he did a good enough job for people to see that he was without sufficient evidence. He's a not very scientific. Other questions? Do I see another hand? I believe our time question period is up right now. Let's hold on to the questions and remember we'll have one more after we conclude. Let's begin the second session with a more technical approach, understanding that in any good discussion, a contest of ideas, you really need to define your terms, and that's almost always very important, and it's critical here, because people don't mean the same things when they say the same words often. What are we talking about when we say things evolve? Well, it gets an extra bump here sometimes, which then goes away. No, that's not evolution, is it? Changes from one creature to another creature, that's a different idea. This is pointed out by G.A. Kirkut, who is an evolutionist, in his book Implications of Evolution. And he makes a very important distinction, which is critical to keep in mind in this kind of discussion. He says there's a theory which states that many living animals can be observed over the course of time to undergo changes so that new species are formed. We do see changes that they call new species. Now, what is a species is another big question that science acknowledges they really can't deal with. Bacteria becomes resistant to penicillin. This one is, this one isn't. They're not. They're different species. But if I'm resistant to penicillin and you're not, it doesn't make us different species. It's a very nebulous term. Theodosius Dobzhansky, again a very representative evolutionist, says a species is what a good taxonomist says a species is. And that's a better definition. But you see things, cows get longer horns or shorter horns or more spots, and sometimes they'll call them new species. And yes, that can be seen. I call it horizontal variation. He calls it the special theory of evolution. But it's the things that we can see, the variations that are sometimes called new species, that are observable. We'll talk more about what kind are. They can be demonstrated in certain cases by experiments. And we can see, for example, the variations in dogs that can be bred within about 25 years from a common ancestor. All of these do interbreed. Sometimes the fox and the wolf are called different species, but they interbreed. Well, that violates some of the definitions of species. But this, I believe, is horizontal variation within the kind and is not really what we're talking about. This is observable. This is not, I believe, the Creator would put within each biotype the capacity to vary, to adapt to different circumstances, to enhance the survivability of the kind. The brown rabbit does fine in Texas. He doesn't do too well on the snows up in the Arctic. And so it varies, but it's still a good rabbit. Kirkut goes on to say, on the other hand, there's a theory that all the living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. This can be called the general theory of evolution. This is on the other hand. This is different. Not the same thing. All things came from a common ancestor. We haven't seen that. One thing changes to another kind, not gets an extra bump or a longer horn. Two different ideas. That's what it's about. This is where the issue is. Not horizontal variation within the kind, but a change from one kind to another kind. And that's essential if we're going to have a good conversation. I had one of the professors say, well, Mr. Patton, don't you believe in change? That's all evolution is. I said, well, yes, I've got some in my pocket, but I think we need to define our terms better if we're going to have a good discussion here. And he didn't appreciate that. But if you focus on this, what you do is eliminate at least 80% of the arguments that are made in favor of evolution. It's all about the little bitty variations that are just bumps and minor differences where the critter stays the same critter. Well, how do you tell whether or not you're making your point or not? Well, we are taught to use the scientific method. It's not used nearly as often as, it's something you talk a lot about. It's not always practiced in the lab. In fact, almost seldom. But it's a good thing, a good goal, and this is what we're taught. There are four primary criteria of the scientific method. It has to be observable. You can't do science on things you can't observe. It has to be repeatable. You do it, somebody else does it, then can demonstrate the results. Experimental, so that you can see the results, and falsifiable. Probably the most unfamiliar term to a general audience. Falsifiability basically is testability. There has to be some kind of test you can devise so that if this happens, it's verified. If this happens, it's falsified. And if it's not at least potentially falsifiable, it's not science. And this may be the most important criteria, several have said. Well, as we look at creation and evolution, how do they stack up with regard to these four criteria of absolute proof of science? Well, in terms of observability in the living world, when we're talking about the general theory, notice the statement by G. Leonard Stebbins of Harvard, again a highly representative evolutionist. The reason that the major steps of evolution have never been observed is that they required millions of years. Okay, that makes sense. You wouldn't observe it, but then still, in terms of our criteria of scientific proof, he's saying you don't observe it. You've got a reason, but you don't, by his own mouth. And so you don't see it in the living world, certainly not the general theory they acknowledge. Well, what about the fossil record? That's supposed to record what happens over millions of years. And we see the same kind of, I would say, crawfishing. Stephen Gould, again, the very representative paleontologist from Harvard, says the extreme rarity of the transitional forms. And how would you see evolution in the fossil record? Well, it transitions from one form to another. The extreme rarity of that in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontologists. We view our data as so bad that we never see the very process we profess to study. At that time, several of these fellows have just passed away almost in 1 year, 2 years. I think he's now a creationist, but at this time he was very definitely an evolutionist. and very representative, and you don't see the change. It's just zap, it's done. And we'll talk more about that when we look at the fossil record Friday evening. What about experimentation? Ernst Mayr, again, the very representative evolutionist from Harvard, says evolutionary biology in contrast with physics and chemistry. Now, physics and chemistry, this is observable, testable, this is hard science. Is a historic, in contrast, evolutionary biology is a historical science. The evolutionist attempts to explain events and processes that have already taken place. Laws and experiments are inappropriate. Now, experimentation is the second or the third criteria here. But you can't do that with historical processes. Here's the evolution of Australopithecus to man. Well, can you redo that? Is that repeatable? No, it's historical and therefore outside of that area. And in terms of testability, if it happened in the past, you can't put it in the test tube and test it. Colin Patterson, who at this time was curator of the largest fossil museum in the world, the British Museum of Natural History, says that these processes are unique and unrepeatable, like the history of England. Unique events are by definition not a part of science, for they are unrepeatable and not subject to test. So as we look at each of the four criteria, evolution fails, that is, in the general sense. You can't prove it. And people jump up and down and say, it's proven. It's absolutely proven, like the science guy. The truth is, neither creation or evolution can be proved by this criteria. We can't repeat creation, can we? Or put it in the test tube. And so in terms of scientific proof, empirical proof, neither can be. They are not subject to those processes. That doesn't mean they're outside of science. Both of them can be investigated scientifically. We've demonstrated some of that. But you proceed differently than the strict scientific method. The proper method is that of model comparison, sometimes called the principle of parsimony. You look at the world that you can see, what is observable through various branches of science, and you see which one explains best and most directly with the fewest secondary assumptions. That is Occam's razor or the principle of parsimony. It doesn't prove, it doesn't reach scientific proof, it is a probabilistic conclusion. This is more likely the better model. And that's good science. It's very scientific, but it doesn't produce proof in either case. But that is the way we'll be proceeding throughout this week, and I think that's the proper approach when we're looking at these two models. Now, let's apply that principle in the rest of the session, looking at what Darwin saw first, and as we compare what he saw, which of the two models is served best by the evidence. He sailed around the world as the ship's naturalist on the Beagle, and especially in the Galapagos Islands, he saw some pretty unusual animals that he hadn't seen in England before. That's different. That's not like the English pigeon that he worked with. And he just said, wow, he didn't reach conclusions at that point. Most of his conclusions came several years later. But especially he was interested in the finches and took a number of specimens and collected those and carried them back to England and thought about them a couple of years later. He said, now, this is proof of evolution, because you look at the islands where these finches are, and the beaks vary on the type of per type of island. The island with a lot of trees have finches with little pointy beaks that can reach in the beak and eat the insects. But the ones without trees have big, heavy beaks that can eat the seeds. And that's where finches with heavy beaks would go. That's where finches with little beaks would go, that is, to those where they could make a living. But he says it was due to evolution. We don't know how they got there. But the beaks were different. I think what he's looking at best, is special evolution. Not even a real good example of that, because we found out that they all interbreed, though he called them different species. That's not evidence for general evolution at all. They didn't become eagles. They didn't become canaries. They still were finches, the kind of finches that we can observe in various places today. Nothing changed from one kind to another kind. And yet you find this in the textbooks as proof of Darwin's theory of general evolution. And more recently, it was reported from two very dedicated scientists who spent a number of years there on these islands that Darwin's finches have evolved right before the scientists' eyes. Now that sounds like the kind of thing that would be good evidence, doesn't it? For the first time, scientists have observed in real time evolutionary changes in one species driven by competition for resources. There was a drought period of several years, and they evolved due to the stress put on by the drought, they say, and they evolved right before this, and they recorded it and documented it, and here's a good example. As you read further in the article, you can learn a little bit more about it. They acknowledge that the difference had to do with the beaks and beak sizes, and that they shrunk by less than 1 millimeter, which is not a whole lot. And I put shrinkage in quotes here because really nothing shrunk. No size changed at all. The smaller size was already there. It's not new. But there got to be fewer of the smaller size and more of the bigger size during the drought, and after the drought, it went right back. But this is proof of evolution, you see. They evolve right before your eyes. Only the relative numbers of the smaller and larger, very small variations, beak size, change. That's all that changed. Well, the relative numbers, not a new anything. Is that Darwin's finches evolving before your eyes? That's not even a good example of the special creation. In fact, as we learn more here earlier this year, it was reported that that speciation has been undone. Now, you didn't see that in the popular press, but in Nature it was reported Darwin's tree of finches have collapsed under conditions of hybridization into two species. There were 13 species, according to Darwin. Now then, they've gone back down to two, and those two interbreed. What we're looking at is horizontal, reversible variation, and that's not what you need as evidence for evolution. I think as you compare the two models, you really don't have a whole lot of help for the general theory of evolution from something like this. What Darwin didn't see, I think, is also important. We see what he saw, and I think it serves creation well. What did he not see? He didn't see a cowbird or a bird dog or any significant change in anything that would cause you to say, well, maybe you got something there. And we see this and we laugh, and it's funny because we know. There's no way, you know, right? Why? Because that doesn't happen. He didn't see this or anything like this. He saw little bitty variations, and they're still finches. And that's all that he saw. That variation is taught as proof in the textbook, but really it's less variation than we see demonstrated with dogs that we can watch interbreed. That's not the issue. That's excluded from the issue of change from one kind to another kind. Very similar to another argument that Darwin made, observing the pepper moths, Bistian betulara, fancy name. for the Mayans. Some of them were light, some of them were dark initially. But before the Industrial Revolution, the trees had light backgrounds, and they were clean, and the light-colored pepper moths got camouflaged, and the dark ones stuck out, and so guess which ones got it? The birds would eat more, and there were fewer of the black ones. After the Industrial Revolution, we're told that the population number shifted somewhat, and there the black ones are camouflaged against the soot-covered trees, and the light ones stood out. And so you've got the situation before and after. There's light and dark before, and there's light and dark after, but the relative numbers have changed. It's very interesting that Harrison Matthews was asked to write the foreword to the centennial edition of The Origin of the Species. 100 years of Darwin are it. This is a celebration. He had the honor in England of writing the foreword. He says in the foreword, "The pepper moth experiments do not show evolution in process." Now, how would we get that idea? Well, it's in every biology textbook in the country. But he says they don't show that. However, the population may alter, all the moths remain from beginning to end, Bistin Bachelera, the same species. And yet, in International Wildlife Encyclopedia, we read, "This is the most striking evolutionary change ever witnessed by man." I think they may be right. That's as good as it gets. And why don't they use better arguments than this? Well, if they had them, they'd use them. This obviously is not general evolution. Furthermore, it gets worse for them. It has been fairly recently discredited, not in the textbooks, but in the technical literature and Nature. Jerry Cohn, who is as vicious an anti-creationist as there is in the country, professor of evolution at University of Chicago, refers to Majerus's experiments with the pepper moths recently and notes that the most serious problem is that Bistin Bachelera probably doesn't rest on tree trunks. Well, I've seen thousands of them on tree trunks in the textbooks. He said, yeah, they glued them there. They pinned them, they glued them, that's how they get the photographs, or drew them there. Exactly two moths have been seen in such a position in more than 40 years of intensive research, reported here in Nature. But it's still there in all of your textbooks as proof. And why do they use that? They don't have better. It's still taught here from Science 2011. Pepper moth, Bistin Bachelera, is one of the most widely recognized examples of contemporary evolutionary change. That's it. That's the evidence. How powerful does that sound? It shows variation, horizontal variation. It is a shift in the relative numbers of pre-existing horizontal variations. That's what it is. That's not general evolution. Now, let me shift gears just a little bit, still in the same general category. Darwin didn't know anything about antibiotic resistance, but it involves small changes like the small changes he observed, and so I'm going to shoehorn it into this section and deal with it here. Because we're often told, and it's in the textbooks, that this is proof of evolution because, look, you see the bacteria becoming resistant to penicillin, and the more penicillin you take, the more resistant it is, and then you have trouble dealing with it later on. And of course, we see something is going on there. We noticed that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton commented on this in the New York Times, says, "I believe in evolution. Antibiotic-resistant bacteria is evidence that evolution is going on as we speak." Now, these are intelligent people, and this looks like evidence of evolution to them, but that's not what's happening. And if we don't really look at what's happening, we're probably not going to be able to deal with it very well. But this is not an evolved change that's being talked about. We got a good indication of that way back in 88, reported in the Medical Tribune, when they found some survivors up in the Arctic. the article says it may be time to rethink our thoughts about the mechanisms for antibiotic resistance patterns. Bacteria from the bowels of three members of an 1845 Arctic expedition have survived 140 years. Okay, bodies 140 years ago found in the Arctic, and they're showing resistance patterns to modern antibiotics. They're resistant not because they're exposed to antibiotics, but they were already there. It didn't evolve. Current theories suggest that antibiotic resistance is linked to long-term exposure to antibiotics. Needless to say, antibiotics were not developed until long after these 19th century bacteria and their host had been buried in the Arctic permafrost. That was a pretty good indication. There have been a number of articles since then in the technical journals demonstrating that it exists in the wild, where we find animals that haven't been exposed to antibiotics out in the woods. And then more recently, this year, I'll spare you the picture, petrified human feces from the 14th century. It was surprising that the ancient stool had more antibiotic resistance genes than modern. 14th century, they got plenty of antibiotic resistant genes. It's not produced, evolved, by exposure to antibiotics. Let me illustrate what's happening this way. Here's the tummy that's got some bad bacteria, and it's upset. And so here's the problem. Here's the bacteria that's causing the problem. Now, some of the bacteria is resistant, as we've seen, going back even to the 14th century. But most of it is not. And so we take the antibiotics, and it wipes out the normal form, and what's left? The resistant form, which then takes over. Now, what have we evolved? We've got less information than we had to start with, don't we? We've lost one of the forms. We haven't evolved anything it was there to start with. But now then it's taken over when you kill off its competitor. It is not evolved. What we do observe as we study bacteria is absolutely astounding creatures that have ability to vary and to adapt to different circumstances and then adapt back. The bacteria can't go, say it's too hot in here, go over to the thermostat and turn the temperature down. It has to adapt its physiology to fit the circumstance, and it does, amazingly. And then when you change that circumstance back, it goes back. We do not observe accumulating change. We see amazing adaptation, but it doesn't continue. It's reversible, and that's not what the evolutionist is looking for. Darwin observed small variations that assumed that these variations would add up over long periods of time to the big ones, which he didn't see. But he could explain the big ones by saying, it's just like the little ones, they just keep on adding up, and eventually you get a flea to become an elephant. And of course, if you have unlimited change, we can understand the logic, though it's not observed. But that was simply assumed. He says it's not testable, as many will say, it takes too long. Well, that's not really true. I believe the assumption has been tested scientifically. I believe it has been falsified wherever it has been tested. For example, we can look at organisms that reproduce very rapidly, millions of generations under observable conditions, many, many, many more generations than would be involved in the supposed change from Australopithecus to man. Millions more. We observe, for example, the fruit flies, which we experiment with in the college classroom, and they've done terrible things to these fruit flies, exposing them to mutagenic chemicals and radiation, and they wind up without wings and different colored eyes and four wings. It's a wonder PETA hadn't gotten involved with all the mistreatment that's got. They're not quite cute enough, I guess. But the reason that we use them is because they have a very high mutation rate, And they reproduce a new generation about every 2 weeks. And boy, you can observe a lot of this going on. And what's happened? And of course, we see the same thing with bacteria. That can reproduce every 20 minutes. Billions of generations observable. But they're still the same kind, the same basic kinds that we observed 300 years ago with bacteria. Michael DeSole, writing in the Encyclopedia of Life Sciences regarding the fruit flies, says, if mutations were a variation of value to the species, then the evolution of Drosophila should have proceeded with extreme rapidity. Yet the facts entirely contradict the validity of this theoretical deduction, for we've seen that the Drosophila type has not been modified in any way in the supposed millions of years that it's been observed from the fossil record. But reproducing every 20 minutes, billions of generations observable in the classroom. Wernher Braun is one of the leading authorities in bacterial genetics. He says, despite the rapid rate of propagation, the enormous size of attainable populations, changes with initially homogeneous bacterial populations apparently do not progress beyond certain boundaries. A lot of variation, but boom, you hit the wall and it stops. This is what we see with Drosophila, and this is what we see with all of the organisms that multiply rapidly. And then sometimes there are other circumstances that allow us to check this assumption. Bacteria would be illustrated in the fossil finds of the same bacteria we got today. Supposed to be a billion years old, the blue-green bacteria. Notice here from Science News, 1 billion-year-old fossils, which I don't buy, but let's play the game their way and see how it comes out. We'll talk about that, I believe, Wednesday evening. They surprisingly looked exactly like what? Modern species. They're a billion years old. And there's the same bacteria which reproduce up to every 20 minutes for a billion years. And what's going on? We're testing the assumption and it doesn't add up. When you can test, it fails the test. We test the assumption with things like the inclusions in amber, which are supposed to preserve things millions of years old. These from National Geographic, over 200 million years old, 356 animal inclusions trapped in tiny drops of ancient amber. You can see some of that back in our museum that we'll talk about in a moment. Surprisingly, these microscopic organisms look quite familiar to today's scientists. They've undergone few or no physical changes. 200 million years. 356 examples. What's happening? We've checked the assumption. That's supposed to add up. The difference between Australopithecus and man is, what, 2 to 3 million years? 200 million. No change. Testing shows the failure of the assumption that the little ones add up to the big ones. And over again, we're seeing scientists acknowledge this. What we're looking at are two observations. First is the variation. That would fit with evolution, though it's not the kind of variation that they're looking for. It certainly fits with creationists who would predict that there would be the ability to adapt, but that they would stay rabbits, they would stay dogs. What we see is the kind of variation that degrades complexity. They're all harmful or neutral in a natural environment. A few of them may be helpful in unusual environments. If the switch breaks, sometimes it's an advantage not to have that switch, but it's not the normal circumstance. They're cyclic. Often they change with the environment and then they change back, and none of them lead to anything novel or new information. They're variations that go back and forth and don't go anywhere. But the evolutionist says, all right, we predict variations, and we do too. So we're at least even at that point. I think there's an advantage for the creationist. But that's not all we see. That's all you see in the textbooks. You also see variation boundaries where you can test the idea that they add up, and you see with the inclusions in the amber, you see with the finches, you see with the bacteria, boundaries. The fruit flies don't continue to add up. And so you're allowed to look at one of the observations, but you can't look at the other one. You keep your blinders on. I don't think that's good science. When we evaluate, we see an obvious advantage. Francisco Elia is the one who came up with and is credited with the modern synthesis. That's the synthesis of Mendelian genetics and Darwinian evolution. That is the modern theory of evolution taught in the textbooks today. He's quoted here in Science as being the major figure in propounding the modern synthesis in the United States. He said, small changes do not accumulate. From his testing, he just flat-footedly says, hey, this doesn't work. And he is the one who came up with the modern concept. Likewise, Stephen Gould, one of the most famous evolutionists in our country, says, I've been watching it slowly unravel. He's talking about what's in the textbooks. As a universal description of evolution, I have been reluctant to admit it since beguiling is often forever, but that theory as a general proposition is effectively dead, despite its persistence as textbook orthodoxy. And of course you've read about that in your textbook. Right. We got two horses in this race, and the bell rings and the gate swings open and one of the horses drops dead. Can you figure out which one's going to win? That's according to the evolutionist analysis. Now, that was 1980. Surely they've solved some of these problems since then. Probably the leading light in biological research today would be Eugene Koonin. He's head of the National Center for Biotechnology Information, the Evolutionary Genomics Research Group. They were responsible for the human genome research. And, there's not a higher authority more respected today. He says in Trends in Genetics that what's in the textbook, the theories they've been teaching, he says it's gone. Traditional concept of the tree of life, that was the way you depict Darwin's theory, he said that's gone. Natural selection as the main driving force of evolution, that's gone. The modern synthesis has crumbled. Apparently beyond repair. Not to mince words, the modern synthesis is gone. And you don't find a higher authority in evolution than Mr. Koonin. Now, obviously, Bill Nye, the science guy, didn't know this, but he is by no means close to the stature and science of this individual. Looking then at the evaluation by the two-model comparison approach, how does creation and evolution explain what we see, what Darwin saw? We see variations, we see boundaries to variations. Well, the variations fit fine, the boundaries do too, just exactly as we would predict. Creation gets along fine with that. Both of them are explained, but variation kind of maybe, but the boundaries don't work, so they explain half of the observations. Which is the better model? The one that explains all you see, or the one that explains half of what you see. Furthermore, this variation is not the kind of variation they're looking for. And Gould says it's dead, and Koonin says it's gone. It's getting worse and worse, isn't it? That little platform is going higher and higher as they learn more about it. Which explains the data best? That's the way you proceed in model comparison. Principle of parsimony. I think it's obvious which model is best. But that's not our purpose, remember, this evening. Our purpose this evening was to define creation science. And I hope by the presentation you've been able to see it's not about Genesis in the classroom, is it? It's not about a failure of imagination. I just can't imagine anything that might do this. It's about looking at the facts and seeing which model fits best and observing the evidence and following the facts where they lead. Now, maybe you reach the conclusion with me that there's an obvious advantage. But that really wasn't what we were doing tonight. We were hoping that you can see how we proceed in creation science, and I hope that's become obvious. And when you hear people saying, well, they just want Genesis in the classroom, you'll know better. And if you want to see what the real evidence, I mean, you think this was good? You haven't seen anything yet. You need to be back tomorrow night, Tuesday night, and see the rest of the evidence that I think overwhelmingly fits creation science better. This universe is our Father's world. And I think you're without excuse if you close your eyes to that fact. If you're here this evening and not a Christian, we want to extend our Savior's invitation. He was the creator of this world, and He is the one to whom you will give an account. If you don't know the evidence for the fact that He is God's Son, give us a chance to show that to you. But if you believe that, come confessing that faith and repenting of your sins, being baptized into Christ. If you've wandered away, come back while we stand together and sing.